Performing arts has the EGOT, people who win an Emmy and a Grammy and an Oscar and a Tony Award. Economics, well, they didn't have anything until today. The first time winner of the TFC, I guess, Treasury, the Fed, and the Council of Economic Advisors. No, does not roll off the tongue, but it is a big deal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 23rd of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You know, we used to play a game on this show called What is Janet Yellen Thinking? Back when she was the Fed chair. And you had to answer in five words or less. Yes, it could be tricky, but my show, my rules, right? Today, we are going to spend a good deal more than five words on what Dr. Yellen is thinking, because the word is President-elect Biden wants to make her his Treasury Secretary. Kate Davidson broke the story for The Wall Street Journal today. Hey, Kate.
Hey, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on, and not on a Friday, as it happens. What do we know about why the president-elect picked Dr. Yellen for this job?
Well, I think that she is very highly regarded, really, by a lot of people. She was nominated by President Obama to be Fed Chair in 2014, and she was approved with, you know, pretty good, mm-hmm. Substantial amount of Republican support. So, you know, Republicans like her, progressives like her, and at this point, she's very much viewed as clearly experienced. She has experience in a crisis. She was at the Fed during the last crisis. She's just a very steady hand. And so we're already seeing a lot of folks coming out saying this is just a really great pick.
Yeah, she's getting a lot of praise. Do you suppose, though, that her time at the Fed, and she was there for a long time, right? She ran the San Francisco Fed. She was the vice chair and then got the chair job. Do you
right.
suppose her time at the Fed makes her or will make her more effective at Treasury?
I think so. I do think that's another key component here, perhaps, of the decision, is that we're at a time where we're seeing a lot of coordination between the Fed and the Treasury. We have since March, when they worked together to mm-hmm. Set up these emergency lending facilities. And so, you know, some folks have noted to me that going forward, where interest rates are pinned again near zero, and we might be entering a period of pretty slow, kind of weak growth, we're going to need more coordination between Treasury and the Fed. And she's someone who obviously knows the ins and outs of the Fed better than probably almost anyone. Yeah. So she's a good choice in that regard, too.
We had a real good example late last week, Thursday, Friday, of some non-cooperation between the Fed and Treasury, with Secretary Mnuchin pulling back the funding for a lot of the lending programs that Chair Powell and the Fed had been doing since March. I imagine, and she has in fact said she favors those kinds of support, so I imagine she would be more in favor of supportive policies than perhaps we're seeing at the end of the Trump administration.
For sure. I think so. And I think that could be one of the first decisions that she makes, is whether to ask. I don't know if she'd have to ask Congress yeah. To step in and do something here. But I mean, I think she could work with the Fed chairman to establish new facilities for sure, and maybe just reopen the ones that have been closed. They would need to come up with some financing for those. I think Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, even though he didn't extend them, he said, well, there's still this pot of money called the Exchange Stabilization Fund you could take from. So we'll have to see. But I think she would be much more receptive to those. And I think it was kind of odd. People thought it was sort of strange that this Treasury Secretary Mnuchin asked for the money yeah. back, which will kind of hamstring them. But she could do that.
Yeah. All right. Super quick. In the 20 seconds we have left, you should have known this was coming. What do you suppose Janet Yellen's thinking right now in five words or less?
Okay, fine. I'll do it. I think she might have been a little, you know, she. I don't think she was angling for this. She wasn't even publicly considered a serious candidate even just a few weeks ago. But I think yeah. when the president calls and asks, you do it. And so I think that might yeah. be where we're at.
I think that's right. Kate Davidson at The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Kate. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon. Wall Street on this first day of a short week, feeling pretty good. Should say, by the way, the whole TFC thing. So Yellen would be the first woman to run the Treasury Department, obviously the first woman to run the Fed. And she was also on the Council of Economic Advisors. She chaired that. She did a number of years ago. Anyway, details and all the rest of it when we do the numbers. Among the things a Treasury Secretary Yellen is going to have on her plate, and there's a lot, as Kate was saying, so it's going to have to be a big plate, is the dollar and its relative strength or not strength in the global economy. Right now, the dollar is particularly not strong, at a 2.5-year low, in fact, which is to say it is slipping in the global foreign exchange popularity contest. Marketplace's Sabri Benishwar explains what's going on.
Investors use the U.S. dollar as a safety blanket when there's a crisis and they are scared. They pile their money in from around the world. The value of the dollar goes up. This is what happened early in the pandemic. But with three solid vaccines on the horizon, investors aren't so scared anymore.
These safe havens are less attractive and people are willing to take on more risk.
Scott Wren is senior global market strategist with the Wells Fargo Investment Institute. Investors are sniffing around other countries, other currencies. That is the charitable explanation. The other thing going on here is that the U.S. dollar is less attractive because the U.S. itself is less attractive.
The overarching reason is that the U.S. simply hasn't done a good job controlling the virus.
Win Thin is global head of currency strategy at Brown Brothers Harriman.
If you look at China, Korea, Taiwan, New Zealand there, I think as well, Singapore, they've all done an incredible job controlling the virus.
Thin says investors have been drawn to those countries and those currencies because their economies are up and running and they're expected to outperform. Meanwhile, the U.S. keeps breaking infection records and is headed for more shutdowns. In normal times, one might be concerned that a falling dollar would increase inflation by making imports more expensive. Ian Shepherdson, chief economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, says that's really not an issue right now.
There's so little danger of imported inflation for goods prices right now because goods are in global oversupply.
And a falling dollar is good for U.S. exporters, even if it is, in part, a macroeconomic indictment of the U.S. management of coronavirus. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishwar for Marketplace.
E-commerce, as we have been telling you, has been booming in this pandemic, and it is going to get boomier this week with Black Friday coming up. Catch is more e-commerce means more imports, and more imports mean a lot of this economy's big ports are backed up. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more.
As the economy has picked up during the pandemic, Dale Rogers at Arizona State University says many importers have been desperate to offload goods they didn't sell earlier this year.
So there's a real expectation that this is where they're going to make it up, is in the fourth quarter.
But it can be challenging to unload the surge in imports we're seeing right now, especially when COVID-19 has limited the number of available dock workers. Weston Labar is the CEO of the Harbor Trucking Association, a coalition of West Coast intermodal carriers.
What would normally be a 4 to 5 day vessel at berth ends up being a 7 to 8 day stay or maybe more for these large vessels.
Those delays have ripple effects. Labar says once containers are emptied, many of them end up sitting around on trucks. That means truck chassis used to haul the containers are in short supply. Overall, he says the system has slowed to a crawl.
When containers don't move, it means that profitability and the ability for individual workers to make money is impacted.
That congestion affects exporters too. Jonathan Gold follows supply chain policy with the National Retail Federation.
If our manufacturers can't get the inputs they need for production and then turn that around and get that back out for an export, you know, it's potential lost sales.
The Federal Maritime Commission says bottlenecks pose a risk to economic growth, job growth, and competitiveness. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
A couple of weeks ago, when Kamala Harris took the stage for the first time as vice president-elect, she thanked her mother that night. And then she went on to thank
women who fought and sacrificed so much for equality and liberty and justice for all, including the Black women who are often too often overlooked, but so often prove they are the backbone of our democracy.
We had Janelle Jones on the program a couple of months ago, back in the summertime. She is the Managing Director of Economic Policy and Research at Groundwork Collaborative. And we had her on to talk about why Black women ought to be the backbone of this economy, too. So with the election behind us and some degree of economic uncertainty still out there, we got Janelle back on the phone. Good to have you back on.
Thanks so much for having me.
I want to pick up with something that you raised the last time we had you on, and it was the idea of centering Black women in this economy as a way to help everybody, in essence, was the way you explained it. I wonder if now, 3 or 4 months later, and an election and all that we've gone through, are you seeing signs that Black women are being centered in this economy any more than they had been?
I'm really, really not, which is not a surprise, but is always a disappointment. I think, you know, the jobs numbers that we recently saw were around 1 million women left the labor force. That is shocking. We're seeing women being pulled from the labor force, and no small part due to the caregiving infrastructure that we just will not even try to build for some reason. And this caregiving crisis is intensified for Black women because we know they are more likely to be single mothers. They're more likely to have care responsibilities. So they really do have to make the choice between caring for children, elderly folks, folks who are sick with the virus, and going to work.
Yeah, well, and as you and I have talked about, Black women are often the primary wage earner in their families. Do you see in the incoming administration any signs of hope? I mean, Vice President Biden, President-elect Biden, rather, said in his speech that night, that Saturday, Black America has had his back and I will have yours.
I will say I actually cheered when I heard that. I love to see us being acknowledged at a really pivotal moment. You know, I think one thing that does give me hope is our vice president-elect is a Black woman. I think it's harder not to center women in these conversations when you're looking at one, when she's the one asking you, what is this policy? Who will it hurt? Who will it help? You know, something that scares me a little bit, honestly, is that we will pivot too soon to austerity. We saw that after the Great Recession, and we know that when that happens, it is often the most marginalized folks who are left behind. And so, you know, a turn to austerity means quite literally a disinvestment from Black and brown communities. It won't give them the resources, the support that they need to survive not just a pandemic, but also an economic recession that seems to be getting worse.
I chuckle only because we did 7 minutes on austerity and the austerity boom that's coming in this economy here now in the next number of months. Other than having the vice president-elect literally in the room now when those decisions are being made, what does it look like when Black women are centered in these policy discussions?
That's a great question. I think another thing that gives me hope in this way that can center Black folks is, you know, we saw a bunch of transition announcements over the past week. And to see women of color, to see Black women being listed as the folks who will give policy proposals, who will give ideas, that makes me super hopeful. In terms of what it looks like to center Black women, I think it means giving support. I think it means measuring success based on that population. You know, there's a lot of talk about how unemployment is low and we're recovering and we're already bouncing back. The Black women unemployment rate is 9.3%. That is a crisis.
You know, it's interesting you pulled out the Black women unemployment rate, because one of the things you and I talked about the first time you were on the program was using disaggregated data instead of just the headline numbers, as so often happens. And I'm reminded of that because I saw a tweet go by this morning from our mutual acquaintance. Well, she's your colleague and friend, and I've met her on the radio, Anagifte Opoku-Agyeman, who talked about having Black people doing the data analysis as a way to get to a more true representation of what's going on in this economy. And I wonder what you think about that.
I think she's exactly right. It is crucial right now as we think about where do we give targeted help? How much help do we need? You know, I see these numbers about a stimulus package and, you know, I hate to break it to folks, but $1 or $2 trillion is just not going to do it. It's just not enough. White women have recovered 61% of the jobs they've lost since the recession. Black women have only recovered 34%. Like, you only get at that disparity if you break down the data by those demographics. And so I think it's really, really important. We can't just run off and say the economy is recovered if it's recovered for white men, while millions of families and communities are left with economic devastation.
Janelle, thanks a lot. Janelle Jones, she is the Managing Director of Policy and Research at the Groundwork Collaborative. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Might I recommend, by the way, that 7 minutes on austerity that I talked about, mostly because it includes this really good way of understanding why austerity, that is to say government belt tightening, can be perilous.
It's a little bit like having to turn into a skid. You know, if your car is skidding, your first instinct is to pull the wheel the other way, and then you just lose traction and fly off the road.
You can find that should you be interested, and honestly, you should be, at marketplace.org. Also, while I have you, quick plug for the Marketplace Morning Report, everything you need to know to start your economic day, from David Brancaccio and the gang that gets out of bed real, real early. Coming up.
They are manufactured in embryonated chicken eggs, and you basically have to inject it into that chicken egg.
Science. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 327 today, 1.1%, 29,591. The NASDAQ added 25 points, about 0.2%, 11,880. The S&P 500 found 20 points, about 0.5%. 35 and 77 there. The United States is ordering General Motors to recall and repair almost 6 million big pickups and SUVs outfitted with Takata airbag inflators. Estimated cost to the car company, $1.2 billion. GM shares up 4% today, cuz. Regeneron says it's going to provide the United States with 300,000 doses of its just-approved COVID-19 antibody treatment by early in the new year. FDA granted that emergency use authorization this past weekend. Shares up 0.9%. Bonds down. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 0.85%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the ways to think about economics, just one of them because there's lots of ways, but one of them is that it's the study of how we allocate scarce resources. And with virus cases rising, healthcare is becoming an increasingly scarce resource. Healthcare facilities and healthcare workers trying their best to deal with a surplus of COVID patients. Marketplace's Andy Euler has the latest from the Texas Panhandle.
Robert Hancock is a physician who treats patients in Texas and Oklahoma. He's seen firsthand what it's like when overwhelmed hospitals experience COVID-19 outbreaks among staff.
I personally tried to transfer a patient and basically tried everywhere within 150 miles and nobody had available ICU beds.
He's forced to keep patients in emergency rooms and ask overwhelmed ER nurses to look after three times the number of patients he says they should. John Henderson with the Texas Organization of Rural and Community Hospitals says staffing problems are getting worse.
Particularly when you go west and northwest in Texas, they're having fits with COVID outbreaks among their staff nurses.
He says another problem for hospitals whose staff contract the virus is that COVID patients often need ventilators and urgent care for a long time.
It's 10 days, 2 weeks in some instances where they're inpatient with intensive staffing and equipment needs.
One of the knock-on effects of staff shortages is that people who have other medical needs are being asked to wait. Nancy Foster is with the American Hospital Association.
If you've been waiting for a few months to get in to have that funny lump that's been seen in your breast cared for, or your circulatory system needs repair, all of those things are urgent and concerning to Americans.
She says hospitals are doing what they can to adapt, cross-training and redistributing work to different personnel, but the strain on staff isn't going to let up anytime soon. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
So we have, as of this morning, three vaccines that look incredibly promising. The University of Oxford and AstraZeneca have joined Pfizer and BioNTech and Moderna in reporting great results. And they have reported those results incredibly quickly, less than a year to get multiple vaccines. The old record, the mumps vaccine, which took 4 years to get to market. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong has more now on how we got here so fast and whether there might be some trade-offs for going too fast.
The World Health Organization held its first emergency meeting on a dangerous new virus back in January.
The evidence points to human-to-human transmission in the context of close contact.
Just days before, researchers in China published the virus's genetic sequence. It showed a virus with a signature spike on the surface. And this let drug companies immediately spring into action, says virologist Angela Rasmussen at Georgetown.
Moderna and Pfizer and all these other vaccine manufacturers started adapting that spike protein sequence to their particular vaccine technology.
Vaccine makers have benefited from a host of time-saving steps and strokes of luck. For one, this virus closely resembles other coronaviruses.
Vaccines were developed for both SARS Classic and for MERS coronavirus. So we could use that pre-existing base of knowledge for this virus.
The first two drug makers out of the gate this spring were Pfizer and Moderna. They use a vaccine technology called messenger RNA, which is built for speed. Rasmussen explains how normal vaccines are made, using the flu as an example.
They are manufactured in embryonated chicken eggs, and you basically have to inject it into that chicken egg, wait for the virus to grow up to large quantities, and then you have to chemically inactivate it.
That's a lot of steps. Messenger RNA requires neither eggs nor chickens. Jason Schwartz, vaccine policy scholar at Yale, says the mRNA injection only delivers genetic instructions.
Essentially, the human body does the vaccine manufacturing, if you want to think of it that way. So it's a slimmed-down package that gets you into the pipeline sooner.
Meantime, the U.S. government brought its own turbocharger this spring, a $10 billion program called Operation Warp Speed.
We ramp up manufacturing of the vaccines while we were running the phase 3 trials.
That's program head Monsef Slaoui in a government video.
If they turn out to be efficacious and the FDA approves them, we will use them.
The idea is the supply would be ready to ship out immediately. The government is also funding what Schwartz calls a terribly expensive step, recruiting people to join vaccine trials. Tens of thousands signed up in mere months.
That's a testament to, I think, the researchers and the efforts to reach potential research subjects. And it's also, I think, a testament of individuals who volunteered.
There's one last time saver to mention, the trials themselves. Now, the key question in any vaccine trial is how many people end up sick, and a trial needs a certain number of sick people before it can wrap up. Now, for these coronavirus trials, the subjects only have to get mild COVID to count. Peter Doshi researches drug policy at the University of Maryland.
If you're measuring a severity of illness that's very common, like mild illness, you will get there much faster than measuring severe illness, which happens less frequently.
This worries Doshi. He says severe cases that lead to hospitalization or death are what really matter. But the trials, as he sees it, are not designed to focus on severe cases and whether vaccines prevent them.
We're not studying them in a rigorous way to find out. So what we'll be left with is this maybe.
Hurrying up can bring other trade-offs. The early vaccines from Pfizer, Moderna, and now AstraZeneca required 2 doses. And Jason Schwartz at Yale says that requires a lot of tracking people and hoping they return for a second shot.
Even just getting people to get 1 dose of the influenza vaccine, we're lucky if we hit 60, 65% of the population. And that's after many, many years of flu vaccine campaigns. So 2 doses will be that much harder.
A separate vaccine being developed by Johnson & Johnson takes just 1 injection. Its trials are still ongoing, but tortoises have been known to outrun hares. And the first vaccine to market isn't always the one that's given to the masses. So we need a lot of runners in this race. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which the American consumer continues to save this economy's bacon. This item from the National Retail Federation this morning. Pandemic or no, the NRF says holiday sales this year are going to go up somewhere between 3.6% and 5.2% over the non-pandemic holidays of a year ago. Now, the National Retail Federation is retail's big lobbying group, so grain of salt, but that is not a small bump. All right, we're going, but not without your Monday moment. Oh, economic context. As we head into what is traditionally one of the busiest travel weeks of the year, my old standby, TSA throughput. This past weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, more than 3 million people in this economy decided to get on an airplane. Those same 3 days a year ago, almost 7 million. Our daily production team is Andy Corbin, Ali Pham, Maria Honhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.